there, with nothing to occupy her hands. The chests on the gallery could wait until Ingrid came in. It had been intended that she would have Frida Stierkar's daughter as her maid when she moved out to the old house. But then Frida married one of the servants who had come with Helga Duke, a lad young enough to be her son. "It's the custom in our part of the country for our servants to listen to their masters when they're offered advice for their own good," said Jofrid when Kristen wondered how this marriage had come about. "But here in this parish," said Kristen, "the commoners aren't accustomed to obeying us if we're unreasonable, nor do they follow our advice unless it's of equal benefit to them and to us. I'm giving you good advice, Jofrid. You should keep it in mind." "What Mother says is true," added Gauta, but his voice was quite meek. Even before he was married, Kristen had noticed that Gauta was very reluctant to speak against Jofrid, and he had become the most amenable of husbands. Kristen didn't deny that Gauta could stand to listen to what his wife had to say about many things. She was more sensible, capable, and hard-working than most women. And she was no more loose in her ways than Kristen herself had been. She, too, had trampled on her duties as a daughter and sold her honor, since she could not win the man she had set her heart on in any better way. After she had gotten what she wanted, she became the most honorable and faithful wife. Kristen could see that Jofrid had great love for her husband. She was proud of his handsome appearance and his esteemed lineage. Her sisters had married wealthy men, but it was best to look at their husbands at night, when the moon wasn't shining. And their ancestors weren't even worth mentioning, Jofrid said scornfully. She zealously tended to her husband's welfare and honor as she perceived it, and at home she indulged him as best she could. But if Gauta suggested that he might have a different opinion from his wife regarding even the smallest matter, Jofrid would first agree with such an expression that Gauta would begin to waver, and then she would bring him around to her point of view. But Gauta was flourishing. No one could doubt that these two young people lived well together. Gauta loved his wife, and both of them were so proud of their son, and loved him beyond all measure. So everything should have been fine and good. If only Jofrid Helgesdottir hadn't been... Well, she was stingy. Kristen couldn't find any other word for it. If she hadn't been stingy, Kristen wouldn't have felt annoyed that her daughter-in-law had such a desire to take charge. During the grain harvest that very first autumn, right after Jofrid had returned to the estate as a married woman, Kristen could see that the servants were already discontented, although they seldom said anything. But the old mistress noticed it just the same. Sometimes it had also happened in Kristen's day that the servants were forced to eat herring that was sour, or bacon as yellow and rancid as a resinous pine torch, or spoiled meat. But then everyone knew that their mistress was bound to make up for it with something particularly good at another meal. Milk porridge, or fresh cheese, or good ale out of season. And if there was food that was about to go bad and had to be eaten, everyone simply felt as if Kristen's full storerooms were overflowing. If people were in need, the abundance at Jorungarde offered security for everyone. But now people were already uncertain whether Jofrid would prove to be generous with the food if there should be a shortage among the peasants. This was what angered her mother-in-law, for she felt it diminished the honor of the manor and its owner. It didn't trouble her as much that she had discovered firsthand, over the course of the year, that her daughter-in-law always saved the best for her own. On St. Bartholomew's Day, she received 2 goat carcasses instead of the 4 she should have been given. It was true that wolverines had ravaged the smaller livestock in the mountains the previous summer, and yet Kristen thought it petty to hold back from slaughtering 2 more goats on such a large estate. But she held her tongue. It was the same way with everything she was supposed to be given from the farm: the autumn slaughtering, grain and flour, fodder for her 4 cows and 2 horses. She received either smaller amounts or poor quality goods. She saw that Gauta was both embarrassed and ashamed by this, but he didn't dare do anything for fear of his wife, and so he pretended not to notice. Gaute was just as magnanimous as all of Erland's sons. In his brothers, Christian had called it extravagance. But Gaute was a toiler, and frugal in his own way. As long as he had the best horses and dogs and a few good falcons, he would have been content to live like the smallholders of the valley. But whenever visitors came to the estate, he was a gracious host to all his guests and a generous man toward beggars, and thus a landowner after his mother's own heart. She felt this was the proper way of living for the gentry, those nobles who resided on the ancestral estates in their home districts. They should produce goods and squander nothing needlessly, but neither should they spare anything whenever love of God and his poor, or concern for furthering the honor of their lineage, demanded that goods should be handed out. Now she saw that Jofrid liked Gauta's rich friends and high-born kinsmen best. And yet in this regard, Gauta seemed less willing to comply with his wife's wishes. He tried to hold on to his old companions from his youth. His drinking cohorts, Jofrid called them, and Kristen now learned that Gauta had been much wilder than she knew. These friends never came to the manor uninvited after he was a married man. But as yet, no poor supplicant had gone unaided by Gauta, although he gave fewer gifts if Jofrid was watching. Behind her back he dared to give more. But not much was allowed to take place behind her back. And Kristen realized that Jofrid was jealous of her. She had possessed Gauta's friendship and trust so completely during all the years since he was a poor little child who was neither fully alive nor dead. Now she noticed that Jofrid wasn't pleased if Gauta sat down beside his mother to ask her advice or got her to talk about the way things were in the past. If the man stayed for long in the old house with his mother, Jofrid was certain to find an excuse to come over. And she grew jealous if her mother-in-law paid too much attention to little Erland. Amid the short, trampled-down grass out in the courtyard grew several herbs with coarse, leathery, dark leaves. Now, during the sunny days of midsummer, a little stalk had sprung up with tiny, delicate, pale blue flowers in the center of each flattened rosette of leaves. Kristen thought the old outer leaves, scarred as they were by each time a servant's foot or a cow's hoof had crushed them, must love the sweet, bright blossoming shoot which sprang from its heart, just as she loved her son's son. He seemed to her to be life from her life and flesh from her flesh, just as dear as her own children, but even sweeter. Whenever she held him in her arms, she noticed that the boy's mother would keep a jealous eye on the two of them and would come to take him away as soon as she deemed it proper, and then possessively put him to her breast, hugging him greedily. Then it occurred to Kristen Lavrun's daughter in a new way that the interpreters of God's words were right. Life on this earth was irredeemably tainted by strife. In this world, wherever people mingled, producing new descendants, allowing themselves to be drawn together by physical love and loving their own flesh, sorrows of the heart and broken expectations were bound to occur as surely as the frost appears in the autumn. Both life and death would separate friends in the end, as surely as the winter separates the tree from its leaves. One evening, 2 weeks before St. Olaf's Day, a group of beggars happened to come to Jorungarð and asked for lodgings for the night. Kristen was standing on the gallery of the old storeroom. It was now under her charge, and she heard Jofrid come out and tell the poor people that they would be given food, but she could not give them shelter. "There are many of us on this manor, and my mother-in-law lives here too. She owns half the buildings." Anger flared up in the former mistress. Never before had any wayfarers been refused a night's lodgings at Jorungarð, and the sun was already touching the crest of the mountains. She ran downstairs and went over to Jofrid and the beggars. "They may take shelter in my house, Jofrid, and I might as well be the one to give them food, too. Here on this manor we have never refused lodging to a fellow Christian if he asked for it in the name of God."
"You must do as you please, mother,"
replied Jofrid, her face blazing red. When Kristen had a look at the beggars, she almost regretted her offer. It was not entirely without cause that the young wife had been unwilling to have these people on her estate overnight. Gauta and the servants had gone up to the hay meadows near Seal Lake and would not be home that evening. Jofrid was home alone with the parish's charity cases, two old people and two children, whose turn it was to stay at Urengard, and Kristen had only her maid in the old house. Although Kristen was used to seeing all kinds of people among the wandering groups of beggars, she didn't like the looks of this lot. Four of them were big, strong young men. Three of them had red hair and small, wild eyes. They seemed to be brothers. But the fourth one, whose nose had once been split open on both sides and who was missing his ears, sounded as if he might be a foreigner. There were also two old people. A short, bent old man with a greenish-yellow face, his hair and beard ravaged by dirt and age, and his belly swollen as if with some illness. He walked on crutches, alongside an old woman wearing a wimple that was completely soaked with blood and pus, her neck and face covered with sores. Kristen shuddered at the thought of this woman getting near Erlon. All the same, for the sake of these two wretched old people, it was good that the group wouldn't have to wander through Hammer Ridge in the night. The beggars behaved peaceably enough. Once the earless man tried to seize hold of Ingrid as she went back and forth to the table, but Bjorn got to his feet at once, barking and growling. Otherwise, the group seemed despondent and weary. They had struggled much and gleaned little, they said in reply to the mistress's questions. Surely things would be better in Nidaros. The old woman was pleased when Kristen gave her a goat horn containing a soothing salve made from the purest lamb oil and the water of an infant. But she declined when Kristen offered to soak her wimple with warm water and give her a clean linen cloth. Well, she would agree to accept the cloth. Nevertheless, Kristen had her young maid, Ingrid, sleep on the side of the bed next to the wall. Several times during the night Bjorn growled, but otherwise everything was quiet. Shortly past midnight, the dog ran over to the door and uttered a couple of short barks. Kristen heard horses in the courtyard and realized that Gauta had come home. She guessed that Jofrid must have sent word to him. The next morning, Kristen filled the sacks of the beggars generously, and they hadn't even passed the manor gate before she saw Jofrid and Gauta heading swiftly toward her house. Kristen sat down and picked up her spindle. She greeted her children gently as they came in and asked Gauta about the hay. Jofrid sniffed. The guests had left a rank stench behind in the room. But her mother-in-law pretended not to notice. Gauta shifted his feet uneasily and seemed to have trouble telling her what the purpose of their visit might be. Then Jofrid spoke. "There's something I think it would be best for us to talk about, Mother. I know that you feel I'm more tight-fisted than you deem proper for the mistress of Urengard. I know that's what you think, and that you also think I'm diminishing Gauta's honor by acting this way. Now I don't have to tell you I was fearful last night about taking in that lot, because I was alone on the estate with my infant and a few charity cases. I saw that you realized this as soon as you had a look at your guests. But I've noticed before that you think I'm miserly with food and inhospitable toward the poor. That is not so, Mother. But Urengard is no longer a grand estate belonging to a royal retainer and wealthy man, as it was in the time of your father and mother. You were the child of a rich man and kept company with rich and powerful kinsmen. You made a wealthy marriage, and your husband took you away to even greater power and splendor than you had grown up with. No one can expect that you in your old age should fully understand how different Gauta's position is now, having lost his father's inheritance and sharing half of your father's wealth with many brothers. But I dare not forget that I brought little more to his estate than the child I carried under my bosom, and a heavy debt for my friend to bear because I consented to his act of force against my kinsmen. Things may get better with time, but I'm obliged to pray to God that my father might have a long life. We are young, Gauta and I, and don't know how many children we are destined to have. You must believe, mother-in-law, that I have no other thought behind my actions than what is best for my husband and our children. I believe you, Jofrid, Kristen gazed somberly at the flushed face of her son's wife. And I have never meddled in your charge of the household, or denied that you're a capable woman and a good and loyal wife for my son. But you must let me manage my own affairs as I am used to doing. As you say, I'm an old woman and no longer able to learn new ways. The young people saw that Kristen had no more to say to them, and a few minutes later, they took their leave. As usual, Kristen had to agree that Jofrid was right, at first. But after she thought it over, it seemed to her... No. All the same, there was no use in comparing Gauta's alms with her father's. Gifts for the souls of the poor and strangers who had died in the parish, marriage contributions to fatherless maidens, banquets on the feast days of her father's favorite saints, stipends for sinners and those who were ill who wanted to seek out Saint Olaf. Even if Gauta had been much richer than he was, no one would have expected him to pay for such expenses. Gauta gave no more thought to his creator than was necessary. He was generous and kind-hearted, but Kristen had seen that her father had a reverence for the poor people he helped, because Jesus had chosen the lot of a poor man when he assumed human form. And her father had loved hard toil and thought all handwork should be honored because Mary, the Mother of God, chose to do spinning to earn food for her family and herself, even though she was the daughter of rich parents and belonged to the lineage of kings and the foremost priests of the Holy Land. 2 days later, early in the morning, when Jofrid was only half-dressed and Gauta was still in bed, Kristen came into their room. She was wearing a robe and cape of gray homespun, with a wide-brimmed black felt hat over her wimple and sturdy shoes on her feet. Gauta turned blood red when he saw his mother dressed in such attire. Kristen said she wanted to go to Nidaros for the feast of Saint Olaf, and she asked her son to look after her chores while she was gone. Gauta protested vigorously. She should at least borrow horses and men to escort her and take her maid along. But his words had little authority, as might be expected from a man lying naked in bed before his mother's eyes. Kristen felt such pity for his bewilderment that she came up with the idea that she had had in a dream. "And I long to see your brothers again." But then she had to turn away. She had not yet dared express in her heart how much she yearned for and dreaded this reunion with her two oldest sons. Gauta insisted on accompanying his mother part of the way. While he dressed and had something to eat, Kristen sat laughing and playing with little Erlan. He chattered on, alert and lively with the morning. She kissed Jofrid farewell, and she had never done that before. Out in the courtyard, all the servants had gathered. Ingrid had told them that Mistress Kristen was going on a pilgrimage to Nidaros. Kristen picked up the heavy iron-shod staff, and since she didn't want to ride, Gauta put her travel bag on his horse's back and let the animal walk on ahead. Up on the church hill, Kristen turned around and looked down at her estate. How lovely it looked in the dewy, sun-drenched morning. The river shone white. The servants were still standing there. She could make out Jofrid's light-colored gown and wimple, and the child like a red speck in her arms. Gauta saw that his mother's face turned pale with emotion. The road led up through the woods beneath the shadow of Hammer Ridge. Kristen walked as easily as a young maiden. She and her son said very little to each other. After they had walked for 2 hours, they reached the place where the road turns north under Roast Peak, and the whole Dovre countryside stretches below to the north. Then Kristen said that Gauta should go no farther with her. But first she wanted to sit down and rest for a while. Beneath them lay the valley with the pale green ribbon of the river cutting through it, and the farms like small green patches on the forested slopes. But higher up, the moss-covered heights, brown and lichen-yellow, arched against the gray scree and bare peaks, flecked with snowdrifts. The shadows of the clouds drifted over the valley in plains, but in the north, the mountains were so brightly lit. One mountainous shape after another had freed itself from the misty cloak and loomed blue, one beyond the other. and Kristen's yearning glided north with the cloud clusters to the long road she had before her and raced across the valley, in among the great barricading slopes and the steep, narrow path through the wilds across the plateaus. A few more days and she would be on her way down through the beautiful green valleys of Trøndelag, following the current of the river toward the great fjord. She shuddered at the memory of the familiar villages along the sea, where she had spent her youth. Erland's handsome figure appeared before her eyes, shifting in stance and demeanor, swift and indistinct, as if she were seeing him mirrored in a rippling stream. At last she would reach Fegginsbrekka, at the marble cross, and Nidaros would be lying there at the mouth of the river, between the blue fjord and the green strand. On the shore, the magnificent light-colored church with its dizzying towers and golden weather vanes, with the blaze of the evening sun on the rose in the middle of its breast. And deep inside the fjord, beneath the blue peaks of Frosta, lay Tautra, low and dark like the back of a whale, with its church tower like a dorsal fin. Oh, Bjørgulf. Oh, Nokva. But when she looked back over her shoulder, she could still catch a glimpse of her home mountain beneath Hovringen. It lay in shadow, but with an accustomed eye she could see where the pasture path wound through the woods. She knew the gray domes that rose up over the carpet of frost. They surrounded the old meadows belonging to the people of Sil. The sound of a lure echoed from the hills. Several shrill tones that died away and then reappeared. It sounded as if children were practicing blowing the horn. A distant clanging of bells, the rush of the river fading lazily away, and the deep sighs of the forest in the quiet, warm day. Kristen's heart trembled anxiously in the silence. Homesickness urged her forward. Homesickness drew her back toward the village and the manor. Pictures of everyday things teemed before her eyes. She saw herself leaping with the goats along the path through the sparse woods south of their mountain pasture. A cow had strayed into the marsh. The sun was shining brightly. When she paused for a moment to listen, she felt her own sweat stinging her skin. She saw the courtyard back home in swirling snow, a dingy white stormy day seething toward a wild winter night. She was almost blown back into the entryway when she opened the door. The blizzard took her breath away. But there they came, those two snow-covered bundles, men wearing long fur coats. Ivar and Skúla had come home. The tips of their skis sank deep into the great snowdrift that always formed across the courtyard when the wind blew from the northwest. Then there were always huge drifts in two parts of the courtyard. All of a sudden she felt herself longing with love for those two drifts that she and all the manor servants had cursed each winter. She felt as if she were condemned never to see them again. Feelings of longing seemed to burst from her heart. They ran in all directions, like streams of blood, seeking out paths to all the places in the wide landscape where she had lived, to all her sons roaming through the world, to all her dead lying under the earth. She wondered, had she turned cowardly? She had never felt this way before. Then she noticed that Gauta was staring at her. She gave him a fleeting, rueful smile. It was time now for them to say goodbye and for her to continue on. Gauta called to his horse, which had been grazing across the green hillside. He ran to get him and then came back, and they said farewell. Kristen already had her travel bag over her shoulder, and her son was putting his foot into the stirrup when he turned around and took a few steps toward her. Mother. For a moment she looked into the depths of his helpless, shame-filled eyes. You haven't been. No doubt you haven't been very pleased the last few years. Mother, Jofrid means well. She has great respect for you. Even so, I should have told her more about the kind of woman you are and have been all your days.
Why do you happen to think about this now, my Gauta?
His mother's voice was gentle and surprised.
I'm quite aware that I'm no longer young.
And old people are supposed to be difficult to please. All the same, I haven't aged so much that I don't have the wits to understand you or your wife.
It would trouble me greatly if Jofrid should think that it has been a thankless struggle, after all she has done to spare me work and worry. Do not think, my son, that I fail to see your wife's virtues or your own loyal love for your mother. If I haven't shown it as much as you might have expected, you must have forbearance, and remember that's the way old people are. Gauta stared at his mother open-mouthed. Mother. Then he burst into tears and leaned against his horse, shaking with sobs. But Kristen stood her ground. Her voice revealed nothing except amazement and maternal kindness. My Gauta, you are young, and you've been my little lamb all your days, as your father used to say. But you must not carry on like this, son. Now you're the master back home, and a grown man. If I were setting off for Romaborg or Yorsal, well, but it's unlikely that I will encounter any great dangers on this journey. I will find others to keep me company, you know. If not before, then when I reach Toftar. From there, groups of pilgrims leave every morning during this time. Mother. Mother, don't leave us. Now that we've taken all power and authority out of your hands, pushed you aside into a corner. Kristen shook her head with a little smile. I'm afraid my children seem to think I have an overbearing desire to take charge. Gauta turned to face her. She took one of his hands in hers and placed her other hand on his shoulder as she implored him to believe that she was not ungrateful toward him or Jofrid. She asked God to be with him. Then she turned him toward his horse, and with a laugh she gave him a thump between his shoulders for good luck. She stood gazing after him until he disappeared beneath the cliff. How handsome he looked riding the big blue-black horse. She felt so strange. She sensed everything around her with such unusual clarity. The sun-sated air, the hot fragrance of the pine forest, the chittering of tiny sparrows in the grass. At the same time, she was looking inside herself, seeing pictures the way someone with a high fever may believe she is peering at inner images. Inside her there was an empty house, completely silent, dimly lit, and with a smell of desolation. The scene shifted, a tidal shore from which the sea had retreated far away. Rounded, light-colored stones, heaps of dark, lifeless seaweed, all sorts of flotsam. Then she shifted her travel bag to a more comfortable position, picked up her staff, and set off down toward the valley. If she was not meant to come back, then it was God's will and useless to be frightened. But more likely it was because she was old. She made the sign of the cross and strode faster, longing just the same to reach the hillside where the road passed among farms. Only for one short section of the public road was it possible to see the buildings of Haugen high on the mountain crest. Her heart began hammering at the mere thought. As she had predicted, she met more pilgrims when she reached Toftar late in the day. The next morning she was joined by several others as they all set off into the mountains. A priest and his servant, along with two women, his mother and sister, were on horseback, and they soon pulled far ahead of those on foot. Kristen felt a pang in her heart as she gazed after another woman riding between her two children. In her group there were two older peasants from a little farm in Dovre. There were also two younger men from Oslo, laborers from the town, and a farmer with his daughter and son-in-law, both of them quite young. They were traveling with a young couple's child, a tiny maiden about 18 months old, and they had a horse, which they took turns riding. These three were from a parish far to the south called Andabu. Kristen didn't know exactly where it lay. On the first evening, Kristen offered to take a look at the child, because she was incessantly crying and moaning. She looked so pitiful with her big, bald head and tiny, limp body. She couldn't yet talk or sit up on her own. The mother seemed ashamed of her daughter. The next morning, when Kristen offered to carry the child for a while, she was left in her care, and the other woman strode on ahead. She seemed a most neglectful mother. But they were so young, both she and her husband, hardly more than 18 years old, and she must be weary of carrying the heavy child, who was always whining and weeping.
The grandfather was an ugly, sullen, and cross middle-aged man. But he was the one who had urged this journey to Nidaros with his granddaughter, so he seemed to have some affection for her. Kristen walked at the back of the group with him and the two Franciscan monks, and it vexed her that the man from Andabu never offered to let the monks borrow his horse. Anyone could see that the younger monk was terribly ill. The older one, Brother Arngrim, was a rotund little man with a round, red, freckled face, alert brown eyes, and a fox-red fringe of hair around his skull. He talked incessantly, mostly about the poverty of their daily life, the friars of Shidon. The order had recently acquired an estate in that town, but they were so impoverished that they were barely able to keep up the services, and the church they intended to erect would probably never be built. He placed the blame on the wealthy nuns in Gimser, who persecuted the poor friars with rancor and malice, and they had now brought a lawsuit against them. He spoke effusively about all their worst traits. Kristen wasn't pleased to hear the monk talk in this manner, and she didn't believe his claims that the abbess had not been chosen in accordance with church law, or that the nuns slept through their daily prayers, gossiped, and carried on unseemly conversations at the table in the refectory. Yes, he even said bluntly that people thought one of the sisters had not remained pure. But Kristen saw that Brother Arngrim was otherwise a good-hearted and kindly man. He carried the ill child for long stretches of the way whenever he saw that Kristen's arms were growing weary. If the girl began to howl too fiercely, he would set off running across the plain, with his robes lifted high so the juniper bushes scratched his dark, hairy legs, and the mud splashed up from the marshy hollows, shouting and hollering for the mother to stop because the child was thirsty. Then he would hurry back to the ill man, Brother Torgils. Toward him, he was the most tender and loving father. The sick monk made it impossible to reach Hiershin that night. But the two men from Dovre knew of a stone hut in a field a little to the south, near a lake, and so the pilgrims headed that way. The evening had turned cold. The shores of the lake were miry, and white mist swirled up from the marshes, so the birch forest was dripping with dew. A slender crescent moon hung in the west above the mountain domes, almost as pale yellow and dull as the sky. More and more often, Brother Torgils had to stop. He coughed so badly that it was terrible to hear. Brother Arngrim would support him and then wipe his face and mouth afterward, showing Kristen his hand with a shake of his head. It was bloody from the other man's spit. They found the hut, but it had fallen in. Then they looked for a sheltered spot and made a fire. But the poor folks from the south hadn't expected that a night in the mountains would be so icy cold. Kristen pulled from her travel bag the cape Gauta had urged her to take, because it was especially lightweight and warm, made from bought fabric and lined with beaver fur. When she wrapped it around Brother Torgils, he whispered, he was so hoarse that he could barely manage to speak, that the child should be allowed to lie next to him. And so she was placed beside him. She fretted, and the monk coughed, but now and then they both slept for a while. Part of the night, Kristen kept watch and tended the fire along with one of the Dovre men and Brother Arngrim. The pale yellow glimmer moved northward. The mountain lake lay white and still. Fish rose up, rippling the surface. But beneath the towering dome on the opposite side, the water mirrored a deep blackness. Once they heard a hideous snarling shriek from the far shore. The monk cringed and grabbed the other two by the arm. Kristen and the farmer thought it must be some beast. Then they heard stones falling, as if someone were walking across the scree over there, and another cry, like the coarse voice of a man. The monk began praying loudly. Jesus Christus Soter, Kristen heard, and Vichit Leo de Tribu Judah. Then they heard a door slam somewhere on the slope. The gray light of dawn began rising. The scree on the other side and the clusters of birch trees emerged. Then the other Dovre farmer and the man from Oslo relieved them. The last thing Kristen thought about before she fell asleep next to the fire was that if they made such little progress during the day, and she would have to give the friars a gift of money when they parted. Then she would soon have to beg food from the farms when they reached Galdal. The sun was already high and the morning wind was darkening the lake with small swells when the frozen pilgrims gathered around Brother Arngrim as he said the morning prayers. Brother Torgil sat huddled on the ground, his teeth chattering, and tried to keep from coughing while he murmured along. When Kristen looked at the two ash-gray monk's cowls lit by the morning sun, she remembered she had been dreaming of Brother Edvin. She couldn't recall what it was about, but she kissed the hands of the kneeling monks and asked them to bless her companions. Because of the beaver fur cape, the other pilgrims realized that Kristen was not a commoner, and when she happened to mention that she had traveled the King's Road over the Dovre Range twice before, she became a sort of guide for the group. The men from Dovre had never been farther north than Hirdshin, and those from Vikvar did not know this region at all. They reached Hirdshin just before Vespers, and after the service in the chapel, Kristen went out into the hills alone. She wanted to find the path she had taken with her father and the place beside the creek where she had sat with him. She didn't find the spot, but she thought she did find the slope she had climbed up in order to watch as he rode away. And yet the small, rocky hills along that stretch of path all looked much the same. She knelt down among the bearberries at the top of the ridge. The light of the summer evening was fading. The birch-covered slopes of the low-lying hills, the gray scree, and the brown marshy patches all melded together. But above the expanse of mountain plateaus arched the fathomless clear bowl of the evening sky. It was mirrored white in all the puddles of water. Scattered and paler was the mirrored shimmer of the sky in a little mountain stream, which raced briskly and restlessly over rocks and then trickled out onto the sandy bank of a small lake in the marsh. Again it came upon her, that peculiar fever-like inner vision. The river seemed to be showing her a picture of her own life. She too had restlessly rushed through the wilderness of her earthly days, rising up with an agitated roar at every rock she had to pass over. Faint and scattered and pale was the only way the eternal light had been mirrored in her life. But it dimly occurred to the mother that in her anguish and sorrow and love, each time the fruit of sin had ripened to sorrow, that was when her earthbound and willful soul managed to capture a trace of the heavenly light. Hail Mary, full of grace. Blessed are you among women, and blessed is the fruit of your womb, Jesus, who gave his sweat and blood for our sake. As she said five Ave Marias in memory of the painful mysteries of the redemption, she felt that it was with her sorrows that she dared to seek shelter under the cloak of the Mother of God. With her grief over the children she had lost, with the heavier sorrows over all the fateful blows that had struck her sons without her being able to ward them off, Mary, the perfection of purity, of humility, of obedience to the will of her father, she had grieved more than any other mother, and her mercy would see the weak and pale glimmer in a sinful woman's heart, which had burned with a fiery and ravaging passion, and all the sins that belong to the nature of love, spite and defiance, hardened relentlessness, obstinacy, and pride. And yet it was still a mother's heart. Kristen hid her face in her hands. For a moment it seemed more than she could bear, that now she had parted with all of them, all her sons. Then she said her last Pater Noster. She remembered the leave-taking with her father in this place so many years in the past, and her leave-taking with Gauta only 2 days ago. Out of childish thoughtlessness her sons had offended her, and yet she knew that even if they had offended her as she had offended her father, with her sinful will, it would never have altered her heart toward them. It was easy to forgive her children. Gloria Patri e Filio e Spiritui Sancto, she prayed, and kissed the cross she had once been given by her father, humbly grateful to feel that in spite of everything, in spite of her willfulness, her restless heart had managed to capture a pale glimpse of the love that she had seen mirrored in her father's soul, clear and still, just as the bright sky now shimmered in the great mountain lake in the distance. The next day the weather was so overcast, with such a cold wind and fog and showers, that Kristin was reluctant to continue on with the ill child and Brother Torgils. But the monk was the most eager of them all. She saw that he was afraid he would die before he reached Nidaros. So they set off over the heights, but now and then the rain was so heavy that Kristin didn't dare head down the steep path with the sheer cliffs both above and below, which she recalled lay all the way to the hostel at Drivdal. They made a fire when they had climbed to the top of the pass and settled in for the night. After evening prayers, Brother Arngrim told a splendid saga about a ship in distress that was saved through the intercession of an abbess who prayed to the Virgin Mary, who made the morning star appear over the sea. The monk seemed to have developed a fondness for Kristin. As she sat near the fire and rocked the child so the others could sleep, he moved closer to her and in a whisper began talking about himself. He was the son of a poor fisherman, and when he was 14 years old, he lost his father and brother at sea one winter night, but he was rescued by another boat. This seemed to him a miracle, and besides, he had acquired a fear of the sea. That was how he happened to decide that he would become a monk. But for 3 more years he had to stay at home with his mother, and they toiled arduously and went hungry, and he was always afraid in the boat. Then his sister was wed, and her husband took over the house and share of the fishing boat, and he could go to the Minorites in Tunsberg. At first he was subjected to scorn for his low birth, but the guardian was kind and took him under his protection. And ever since Brother Torgils Olafsson had entered the Brotherhood, all the monks had become more pious and peaceful, for he was so pious and humble, even though he came from the best lineage of any of them, from a wealthy farming family over in Slán. And his mother and sisters were very generous toward the monastery. But after they had come to Shidan, and after Brother Torgils had fallen ill, everything had once again become difficult. Brother Arngrim let Kristin understand that he wondered how Christ and the Virgin Mary could allow the road to be so full of stones for his poor brothers. They too chose poverty while they lived on this earth, said Kristin.
That's easy for you to say, being the wealthy woman that you surely must be, replied the monk indignantly. You've never had to go without food.
And Kristin had to agree that this was true. When they made their way down to the countryside and wandered through Uppdal and Soknadal, Brother Torgils was allowed to ride part of the way, but he grew weaker and weaker, and Kristin's companions changed steadily as people left them and new pilgrims took their place. When she reached Stourin, no one remained from the group she had traveled across the mountain with except the two monks. And in the morning Brother Arngrim came to her, weeping, and said that Brother Torgils had coughed up a great deal of blood in the night. He could not go on. Now they would doubtless arrive in Nidaros too late to see the celebration. Kristin thanked the brothers for their companionship, their spiritual guidance, and their help on her journey. Brother Arngrim seemed surprised by the richness of her farewell gift, for his face lit up. He wanted to give her something in return. He pulled from his bag a box containing several documents. Each of them was a lovely prayer followed by all the names of God. A space had been left on the parchment in which the supplicant's name could be printed. Kristin realized that it was unreasonable to expect the monk to know anything about her, the name of her husband or his fate, even if she mentioned her family name. And so she simply asked him to write, "The Widow Kristin." Walking down through Gauldal, she took the paths on the outskirts of the villages, for she thought if she met people from the large estates, it might turn out that they recognized the former mistress of Husaby. She didn't fully know why, but she was reluctant for this to happen. The following day she set off along the path through the woods on the mountain ridge to the little church at Vatsfjeld,
which had been consecrated to John the Baptist, although the people called it St. Edwin's Church. The chapel stood in a clearing in dense forest. Both the building and the mountain behind were mirrored in a pond from which a curative spring flowed. A wooden cross stood near the creek, and all around lay crutches and walking sticks, and on the bushes hung shreds of old bandages. There was a small fence around the church, but the gate was locked. Kristen knelt down outside and thought about the time she had sat inside with Gauta on her lap. Back then she was dressed in silk, one of the group of magnificently attired noblemen and women from the surrounding parishes. Sira Eiliv stood nearby, holding Nokva and Bjørgl firmly by the hand. Among the crowd outside were her maids and servants. Then she had prayed so fervently that if this suffering child would be given his wits and health, she would ask for nothing more, not even to be freed from the terrible pain in her back which had plagued her ever since the birth of the twins. She thought about Gauta, so stalwart and handsome he looked on his huge blue-black horse, and about herself. Not many women her age, now close to half a century, enjoyed such good health. That was something she had noticed on her way through the mountains. Lord, if only you would give me this and this and this, then I will thank you and ask for nothing more except for this and this and this. Surely she had never asked God for anything except that he should let her have her will. And every time she had been granted what she asked for the most part. Now here she sat with a contrite heart, not because she had sinned against God, but because she was unhappy that she had been allowed to follow her will to the road's end. She had not come to God with her wreath or with her sins and sorrows, not as long as the world still possessed a drop of sweetness to add to her goblet. But now she had come, after she had learned that the world is like an alehouse. The person who has no more to spend is thrown outside the door. She felt no joy at her decision, but it seemed to Kristen that she herself had not made the choice. The poor beggars who had entered her house had come to invite her away. A will that was not her own had put her among that group of impoverished and ill people, and invited her to go with them, away from the home she had managed as the mistress and ruled as the mother of men. And when she had consented without much protest, she knew that she did so because she saw that Gauta would thrive better if she left the estate. She had bent fate to her will. She had obtained the circumstances she wanted. Her sons she could not shape according to her will. They were the way God had created them, and their obstinacy drove them. With them she could never win. Gauta was a good farmer, a good husband, and a faithful father, a capable man and as honorable as most people. But he did not have the makings of a chieftain, nor did he have the inclination to long for what she had desired on his behalf. Yet he loved her enough to feel tormented, because he knew she expected something else of him. That was why she now intended to beg for food and shelter, even though it hurt her pride to arrive so impoverished. She had nothing to give. But she realized that she had to come. The spruce forest covering the slope stood drinking in the seeping sunlight and swayed softly. The little church sat silent and closed, sweating an odor of tar. With longing, Kristen thought about the dead monk who had taken her hand and led her into the light emanating from the cloak of God's love when she was an innocent child, who had reached out his hand to lead her home, time after time, from the paths on which she had strayed. Suddenly she remembered so clearly her dream about him the night before, up in the mountains. She dreamed that she was standing in the sunshine in a courtyard of some grand estate, and Brother Edwin was walking toward her from the doorway to the main house. His hands were full of bread, and when he reached her, she saw that she had been forced to do as she envisioned, to ask for alms when she came to the villages. But somehow she had arrived in the company of Brother Edwin, and the two of them were traveling together and begging. But at the same time she knew that her dream had a double meaning. The estate was not merely a noble manor. but it seemed to her to signify a holy place. And Brother Edvin belonged to the servants there, and the bread which he offered her was not simply flat bread the way it looked. It signified the host, Panis Angelorum, and she accepted the food of angels from his hand. And now she gave her promise into Brother Edvin's hands. Chapter 5. Finally, she had arrived. Kristin Lavrans' daughter sat and rested in a haystack on the road beneath Sion Castle. The sun was shining, and the wind was blowing. The part of the field that had not yet been cut undulated with blossoming straw, red and shiny like silk. Only the fields of Trøndelag were ever that color red. At the bottom of the slope she could see a glimpse of the fjord, dark blue and dotted with foam. Fresh white sea swells crashed against the cliffs of the shore for as far as she could see below the green forested promontory of the town. Kristin let out a long breath. All the same, it was good to be back here. Good even though it was also strange to know that she would never leave here again. The gray-clad sisters out at Rhine followed the same rules, St. Bernard's rules, as the brothers of Tautra. When she rose before dawn and went to church, she knew that Nokva and Bjørgulf would also be taking their places in the monk's choir. So she would end up living out her old age with some of her sons after all, although not in the way she might have imagined. She took off her hose and shoes to wash her feet in the creek. She would walk to Nidaros barefoot. Behind her on the path leading up over the castle's summit, several boys now appeared, gathering around the portal to see if they could find a way into the fortress ruins. When they caught sight of Kristin, they began shouting crude words at her while they laughed and hooted. She pretended not to hear until a small boy, he couldn't have been more than 8, happened to roll down the steep incline and nearly rammed into her, uttering several loathsome words he had boldly learned from the older ones. Kristin turned around and said with a little laugh, "You don't need to scream for me to know you're a troll, child. I can see that by the tumbling pants that you're wearing." When the boys noticed the woman was speaking, they came bounding down, the whole pack of them. But they fell silent and grew shame-faced when they saw she was an older woman wearing pilgrim's garb. She didn't scold them for their coarse words, but sat there looking at them with big, clear, calm eyes and a secretive smile on her lips. She had a round, thin face with a broad forehead and a small, curving chin. She was sunburned and had many wrinkles under her eyes, yet she didn't look particularly old. Then the most fearless of the boys started talking and asking questions in order to conceal the confusion of the others. Kristin felt so merry. These boys seemed to her much like her own daredevils, the twins, when they were small, although she hoped to God that her sons had never had such filthy mouths. These boys seemed to be the children of smallholders from town. When the moment came that she had longed for during the whole journey, when she stood beneath the cross on Fegin's Brekka and looked down at Nidaros, she wasn't able to muster her soul for prayers and devotion. All the bells of the town began pealing at once, summoning everyone to Vespers, and the boys all started talking at once, eager to point out to her everything in sight. She couldn't see Tautra because a squall was blowing across the fjord toward Frosta, bringing fog and torrents of rain. Surrounded by the group of boys, she made her way down the steep path through the Steinberg cliffs, as cowbells began ringing and herders shouted from all sides. The cows were heading home from the town pastures. At the gate in the town rampart stood Nidaride. Kristin and her young companions had to wait while the livestock was driven through. The herders hooted and yelled and scolded, the oxen butted, the cows jostled each other, and the boys told her who owned each and every bull. When they finally went through the gate and walked toward the fenced lanes, Kristin had more than enough to do watching where she set her bare feet between the cow dung in the churned-up track. Without asking, a few of the boys followed her all the way to Christchurch. And when she stood amid the dim forest of pillars and looked toward the candles and gold of the choir, The boys kept tugging at Kristen to show her things. From the colored patches of light that the sun on the rose window cast through the arches, to the gravestones on the floor, to the canopies of costly cloth above the altars. All things that were most likely to catch a child's eye. Kristen had no peace to collect her thoughts, but every word the boys uttered aroused a dull, deep longing in her heart, for her sons above all else, but also for the manor, the houses, the outbuildings, the livestock. A mother's toil and a mother's domain. She was still feeling reluctant to be recognized by people who might have been friends with Erland or her in the past. They always used to spend the feast days at their town estate and have guests staying with them. She dreaded running into a whole entourage. She would have to seek out Ulf Haldorsson, for he had been acting as her envoy with regard to the property shares she still owned up here in the north, and that she now wanted to give to the Rhine Convent in exchange for a corridy. But she knew that a man who had served as one of Erland's guardsmen while he was sheriff was supposed to be living on a small farm out near Brotter. He fished for white-sided dolphins and porpoises in the fjord and kept a hostel for seafarers. All the lodgings were full, she was told, but then Almund, the owner himself, appeared and recognized her at once. It was strange to hear him call out her old name.
"If I'm not mistaken, aren't you Erland Nikolausen's wife from Husaby? Greetings, Kristen. How is it that you've come to my house?"
He was more than happy if she would accept such lodgings for the night as he could offer, and he promised that he himself would sail to Tautra with her on the day after the feast. Late into the night she sat outside in the courtyard, talking with her host, and she was greatly moved when she saw that Erland's former subordinate still loved and esteemed the memory of his young chieftain. Almund used that word about him several times, young. They had heard from Ulf Haldorsson about his unfortunate death, and Almund said that he never met any of his old companions from the Husaby days without drinking a toast to the memory of their intrepid master. Twice, some of them had collected money and paid for a mass to be said for his soul on the anniversary of his death. Almund asked many questions about Erland's sons, and Kristen in turn asked about old acquaintances. It was midnight before she went to bed, lying down beside Almund's wife. He had wanted both of them to give up their bed for her, and in the end she had to agree to take at least his half. The next day was the vigil of St. Olav. Early in the morning Kristen went down to the Skerries to watch the bustle along the wharves. Her heart began pounding when she saw the Lord Abbot of Tautra come ashore, but the monks who accompanied him were all older men. Just before mid-afternoon prayers, the crowds began heading toward Christ Church, carrying and supporting the ill and the lame, to find room for them in the nave so they would be close to the shrine when it was carried past in procession the following day after High Mass. When Kristen made her way up to the stalls that had been put up near the cemetery wall, they were mostly selling food and drink, wax candles and cushions woven from reeds or birch twigs to kneel on inside the church, she happened to meet the people from Andebu again. Kristen held the child while the young mother went to get a drink of local ale. At that moment a procession of English pilgrims appeared, singing and carrying banners and lighted tapers. In the confusion that ensued as they passed through the great crowds around the stalls, Kristen lost sight of the people from Andebu, and afterward she couldn't find them. For a long time she wandered back and forth on the outskirts of the throngs, hushing the screaming child. When she pressed the girl's face against her throat, caressing and consoling her, the child would put her lips to Kristen's skin and try to suckle. She could tell the child was thirsty, but she didn't know what to do. It would be futile to search for the mother. She would have to go into the streets and see if she could find some milk. But when she reached Upper Longstrita and tried to turn north, there was again a great crush of people. An entourage of horsemen was coming from the south, and at the same time a procession of guardsmen from the king's palace had entered the square between the church and the residence of the Brothers of the Cross. Kristen was pressed back into the nearest alleyway, But there, too, people on horseback and on foot were streaming toward the church, and the crowds grew so fierce that she finally had to save herself by climbing up onto a stone wall.